Hello, hello. nothing like a good cup of coffee. You know? So, I have some books there. I don't know if you want me to mention anything about them. I mentioned panel throughout. There's a book there, Blink by Malcolm Gladwell. How many of you have heard of the book? Okay, maybe didn't read it. There's an incident in there or a story in there that I want to tell you about. And so you didn't ask me a question, but I'm going to say it. Malcolm Gladwell himself is biracial. His mother was Jamaican. And he had found in, well, first of all, the idea, the thesis behind Blink is that there's one part of our brain, possibly the mammalian brain, that knows something like that, doesn't have to process it discursively. It could quite possibly be the part of the brain that relates much as the unconscious does. It knows things as a whole, okay? It's important to know, and he develops this, that what it knows is not necessarily right and correct, or would not necessarily coincide with our values. But it is a kind of knowing that has so much sway in our life. Okay, so he then became aware there was a test you could take on the computer. It's called an association test to measure one's embedded racism. Okay, and it has to do with the speed at which, you know, there's this sort of tenet or assumption that if it takes you a long time to associate two words in some way, then you can't do it spontaneously. There's a little conversational conflict inside of yourself trying to do it. Well, I won't take the time to describe the whole test, but it basically came down to associating good words and bad words with white people or black people. But it was done much more, you know, obscure. There's something, thank you. Nuanced. Okay, you can be my word giver. So he took it, and over again, he tested relatively hard. Now, this is a man who, I mean, he staked his life on interracial justice and relationships, and, you know, it's embedded right in him that he's biracial. And so he did not like to find this prejudice in himself. And what I'm asking you as I go through this example, to think of things that you find that you're either prejudiced about, that is, you don't like the value in you, pulsing, the good I want to do, I find myself not doing. Okay? Not necessarily on the racial spectrum, but on any spectrum. Okay, he found that he would take it, you know, and then maybe take it 2 or 3 weeks later, and he was amazed that he was almost the exact same score every time. And then one day, the score was considerably better in that there was less evidence of that. And he thought, gosh, I wonder what I did. Did I do anything different? And he discovered, and I've heard the story 2 ways, that he had spent that morning reading a biography of Martin Luther King. The other is that he had spent the morning watching Race and Track, of which black athletes perform very well and carry cachet, carry a sense of that, you know, this is good. At any rate, he then started to look at this possibility, and that is, if we have sort of deep-seated prejudice or attitudes that don't agree with our conscious value system, is there anything we can do about it? And what he has developed is, yes, we can. Yes, we can. We can do it by spending time with beauty, spending time with things that, say, assume the attitude we want to assume. Isn't that hopeful? I intuitively maybe knew this when one year when I was very, very busy and very whatever, troubled about many things kind of thing, and an Advent came, and I thought, I don't want to do an Advent practice. So especially I didn't want to do one of abdication and, you know, giving up something. And it occurred to me to spend Advent with beauty. And so I went to our public library, and then I got out all these big books with pictures of the Madonna and of, you know, beautiful works of art on the season. And I spent time, because this is the key thing, can't be done with just an intent, spend time with that. And I felt that it was most likely the best thing I could have done for my tired soul. To spend time with beauty. And so there might be analogous things you could devise for yourself that you could spend time with that would seep deep down into the unconscious and help it shift. I think this is what's behind, even though I don't particularly like it, behind things like affirmations. You know, one reason I think I have a little aversion to affirmations is so many of them were taken on by the New Age people in which you imaged getting a Cadillac or a Peugeot or something like that. It was deeply materialistic, you know, and deeply in the direction that most of us are trying not to go. But I think that affirmation, so to speak, work. And so it might be that those values that you most consciously want to identify yourself with, and yet it falls in this category of the good I would not want, I find myself not doing, there might be a way to slip around the backside and just foster that. So are there questions? Are there comments? Things you'd like to say? Yes.
The second exercise that we did not do.
Yes.
Is that done similar to the first one?
Yes.
We would just sit and think about the fear.
But starting first with breathing.
Yeah.
And it's interesting, she has us attend to the out-breath rather than the in-breath. And some of that has to do with the out-breath really more deeply brings us to that unconscious place. The in-breath more deeply brings us, is an energizing breath. If you go to Pilates, you know, they want you to, you want to breathe in oxygen, and that raises your heart rate. Breathing out lowers your heart rate. And so I think, though I pronounced it, if that's why she has to attend to the out-breath rather than the in-breath. Yeah.
You think we have time to do it now?
Would you like?
Yes. Well, yeah. What else?
No, wait.
Are there other things on people's
minds? Yeah, maybe so. Let's see if there are other things. We'll see if that's on. I have to get my folder wherever I put it. Yeah.
I just wanted to clarify on the ego. I'm really glad that you talked about that because I did particularly like Nolan's approach to the ego, because he actually does identify the ego as a sinful, the law of sin within ourselves. And so I just want to clarify for myself this development of the ego, as you say, to let go of the ego. But the ego isn't a bad thing. It's our over-identification with the separateness of the ego from the whole that we need to relax. Wouldn't you say that the ego itself isn't our sinful side?
Yeah, I don't agree with it. And I think he doesn't either, in that he's moving toward the notion of the liberated ego.
Okay.
So if you can liberate the ego isn't essentially bad. And, you know, I would describe, I didn't read that last chapter, but if I were to describe the liberated ego, it would be not only one that sees what it sees, as opposed to projecting, which is what we tend to do. We see what we want to see, kind of thing. It can watch our thoughts and know that we're not the origin of our thoughts. We can just watch them. We can relate to our thoughts. We can relate to our feelings. But that it is essentially a part that feels forgiven, and so therefore is forgiven. And that is what I think constitutes that. If one has no need of forgiveness, then you're going to be in an ego that is still associated with what psychologists call the grandiose ego. And the grandiose ego is an ego that still can't get it, they're not gone. The grandiose ego is that they still can't get it, that they're not God. And we say in psychology, you know, that it's sort of important for children when they're 3 and 4 to have some experience of grandiosity, some experience of moving the world, you know, because that actually builds a sort of healthy entitlement. The entitlement, I have a right to be alive, okay, at 3 and 4. And then, if you can relieve them of that of that identification, you know, gently over the next batch of years, you know, then you get someone who is aware that they're no longer center of the universe. And then gradually it goes further, because not only are we not, is the ego not the center of the universe, it's not the center of our being. The self is. And so we have a kind of Copernican revolution that has to happen twice. We have to move from the idea that the Earth is the center of the solar system. Can you imagine what a shock that was for me? You know? To the idea of being heliocentric, the sun is, you know, and so now on Earth. One of the practices I do is I try to practice imaging, not seeing the sunrise, but the Earth turning toward the sun. Mm. You know, just to have that sort of sense of we're turning toward the sun as a sort of metaphor for what I hope my life will do. Turn toward that which is larger than myself. It's interesting, I can really do it now. That is, I can I wake up every morning at 6 and I can look out of my window, and as the trees get more and more light, I can really have that sense of, and I because the sun's back here, so bending back into the sun, you know. And I think that is one of those things, like the other exercise, that can change the unconscious attitude that I am center of myself and I'm the center of the world. Yeah.
Many of us who were raised in the Catholic tradition kind of come at life with the assumption that we are body and soul, mm-hmm. and that our soul is immortal and our body is not.
Mm-hmm.
How do we put that image together with some of these newer images like ego and self, mm-hmm. and spirit? And
mm-hmm. A lovely question. Do you know any of Hildegard of Bingen's material? She has, in addition to incredible music, she has a book that I think Matthew Fox put out some time back called Illuminations. She had all of these, I'm really answering that, she had all of these visions, and she had one of her nuns, she was like a, I don't know, 13th century, 14th, 15th century nun. She had all of these visions that she had a nun paint, and there's one particular one that I just love. And it's a picture of the fall.
Of the
fall. You know, like the
the fall of Adam.
Adam and Eve. Okay? Adam and Eve. And, you know, we really get the idea of Adam and Eve. It was all about maybe sex, maybe, but it was all about the body.
Yes.
You know? And what she, this was this vision she had, that Adam said, was that he would only look and he wouldn't taste and touch the world. Can you imagine how our way of being would be different if you were sort of told, be as sensual as you can be, touch, taste, eat, you know? And so that's how and Matt Fox, who does an awful lot of that, of really celebrating in one of his books, Original Blessing. You know, really that the original state was a blessed state. And you can't do that without celebrating body. You know, the body is the original blessing. And that sin is not the body doing bad things. Sin is, well, I think this is how Matt Fox, it's dualism. Where dualism is all or nothing. All or nothing, in psychology, we call that splitting. It's not good. It means that you can't hold the tension of the opposites. You know, and life is all about the tension of the opposites, holding them. Holding them until a third comes out of them, which allows you to move forward. But that all or nothing, which is perfectionist, I'm either perfect or I'm nobody. You know, that Matt Fox describes as sin. And so it's not as though we can't sin through the body, but most likely most of us sin much more through things like either depression or rage or guilt or what I call preoccupation with self. Just, you know, always being self with reference more than we do through the body. So, but, you know, there are lots of ways of really, I think, engaging the body. You know, the literature out there is, you know, taking a walk, having a bath.
I think my question was more about the ego and the self and where they fit. Are they part of the spirit? Or where do they fit in all this?
I think... it's not as though in this technology, schema, you don't use the word soul as that which enlivens, you know, the body or the universe. But the way we were taught it was so dualistic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, it wasn't like there's soul in the flesh and there's flesh in the soul.
Yeah.
You know, that kind of way in which the Chinese, if they talk about two-ness, the Chinese, like yin and yang, they never talk about two-ness the way we do. They talk about two-ness because things aren't often in twos. But there's always some of this in here and some of this in there. You know, there is contamination. And that's all the difference. Because, you know, the wonderful statement, the opposite of any good truth is also true. Now, Aristotle didn't think that. But Aristotle is the guy who most likely got us into most trouble. You know?
It kind of reminds me of, like, in the shaman tradition, where the whole reason for illness is when the body is not ensouled.
Yes.
When the soul has left.
Yes.
And the whole thing is to retrieve the soul.
Yes.
To be in, so that the body is ensouled at all times. Does that help at all in the ego and the self? I mean, I see that kind of as maybe not.
Yeah. Very nice. Your statement makes me think of something that I had planned to say, and that is that. There's sort of two things we can do, maybe many more because they're articulate, that's problematic in terms of the ego. One I've mentioned several times, the preoccupied ego. But the other is the dead ego. You know, the dead ego. And it's the, you know, instead of then being a lively person or self, you are sort of a pretend one. Because that pretend one is the one that you thought of might work, you know? But it doesn't come from an ensouled place. And this experience I have with, I often work with people very long term, and I'm sure you've heard this, that when people go to therapy, they often feel worse before they feel better. And one reason is that hopefully early on, some of the anesthesia will wear off. And when anesthesia wears off, it doesn't feel good. It feels, you know, if you think of when we had dental work done, like everything is bulbous and uncomfortable. Because many of us have, and this is not an all or nothing thing, many of us have managed life and managed our feelings by being dead. And we might have done that in only one area. You know, we might have done it in a good part of our life. But to move from that place to feeling again is treacherous, takes time. But it's sort of like worth it.
Would you say self-absorption is a form of preoccupation?
Yes, yeah.
And how do you differ in your judgment?
I'd just say two different words for the same thing. Okay. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
That's more of a new age term, self-absorption.
I don't know. I mean, that's a good word. Yeah. Any other comment or?
I was telling someone this has been a very stimulating week for me, and this is part of it.
Uh-huh.
I heard a man named Stanislav Grof talk on Monday, very, very fascinating. And he talked a lot, but he was dealing with the question of violence and what makes us violent.
Mm-hmm.
And in the course of that, he talked quite a lot about the man, a chemist, I think, who had discovered LSD.
Uh-huh.
And how he had inadvertently, this chemist, become intoxicated as he was working with the material, and somehow had a very unitive vision and mystical kind of experience in which he felt one at one with everything.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, this man now, he had photographs of him, and I don't remember his name. But
Hoffman.
So now he's 102 years old. And what he's doing, he said he's very preoccupied with the beauty of flowers and what makes the color of flowers so intense and wonderful.
Mm-hmm.
And he said all he does is think about beauty.
And 102.
And healthy and going.
Wonderful,
You know, years ago, like in the 50s, some years ago, Jean Houston did some of the primary research with LSD. And then, of course, it got banned totally. And I think that the most likely with great care, Stanislav Grof, with his rebirthing kind of thing, I don't know all of his language, you know, has done that, where a person in some way goes back to a kind of beginning place and starts again. I think that has to be done with incredible care. All my sense is that he is a good clinician who has done that, but it is also open to such abuse because, sort of going back to square one is not an easy thing to do. The book's Shock Doctrine that I talked about begins with an incredibly troubling chapter. Incredibly troubling. It is the use by our government of shock treatment on patients, mainly in Canada, because they couldn't do it in the United States. The belief was that if you gave a person shock treatments over and over again, you could bring them back to some kind of core place, and then you could teach them what you wanted to teach them. But when they found is you bring them back, that doesn't necessarily mean you brought them back to a place you can begin. And that chapter alone is a chapter that will just after each one of these chapters, I had thank goodness my husband was reading it with me, because we could validate with one another just how frightening this material is. Yeah.
When I was a student nurse in the 1950s at the University of Minnesota hospitals, we had a patient who had severe obsessive compulsive disease.
And what they did was they did this. They called it regression of shock, and they took her back to infancy, and he fed her with a bottle.
Uh-huh.
And she was a woman probably in her, I'd say, 30s or 40s. And I have no idea, because we rotated on, how that ever ended, but
yeah,
she was literally taken back to infancy.
Well, this was reputable stuff being done before, and then it was, that level of doing it was prohibited in the United States, and it was funded by the CIA in Canada as a secret project, you know, in which these people were supposed to be, indoctrinated. But there's some first-hand stories in there, you know. I myself have witnessed shock treatment, and it's done now in so much gentler form, a very, very gentler form, so much so that a person needs, say, 6 treatments to make a difference. And it can make a difference if you have intractable, really intractable depression. And I think that one would want it to be at the end of the line.
But I often think about this. If we think about complicity, and I look back at this, incident similar to where I was innocently, in some ways, taking, and I wasn't in charge. I didn't make any decisions. I was very low, but I still was. It's kind of the complexity of what is, I guess we would call sin or whatever.
Uh-huh.
That we have participated in just because we exist in this society.
Well, first of all, I think that if we think we can live, and I'm sitting here thinking, without sinning, or we think we can live without doing violence, that we can't live except at the expense of others. And I think if we can in some way be kind toward that place, then we do not live except at the expense of others. And that what we try to do is mitigate that. We try to make our footprint as light as we can. We try to be, as little violent as we can. But that that's part of incarnation. Because incarnation means that we're not no longer infinite, we're now finite. And when we're finite, 2 bodies can't occupy the same place at the same time. So as a result of incarnation, we have to make choice. We don't have an infinite array of things we can do. And choice is in itself the limit. And some of the choices are that we find in hindsight, or maybe even then, that we participate in something that is not at all lovely. And so you might be a member of the Senate and you participated in a vote, which now you look back at and you would say, that was not lovely, And most of us have things of some sort like that in our lives. And again, coming back to the preoccupation, the task would be not to be self-absorbed about it or preoccupied with it. It is grandiose to be a person who can't be forgiven. If we can't be forgiven, we're holding on to grandiosity because it's holding on also to an idea that maybe I'm exceptional and I thought I could be perfect. And so if I find that I have to be forgiven, it means that I am not. Mm-hmm. But that's radically who we are. We are people who can sin. And we are people who can strive with grace, I think, to mitigate that less and less. Yes, Barbara.
It bothers me that it's just mitigation. I think that we're called to connectedness.
Yes.
And called to community. And biologically, our whole systems are geared that way. Cells get together and work as colonies. Colonies work as organs and systems. That's how we evolve. We're meant to be with one another, and I think our self-absorption and our individualism has cut us off from that idea of community. And that to me, is where we're sitting, is that we're not training our minds, we're not sitting with. As you said, that's what we want to be, is in community. Maybe we need to sit with that a while and change our minds so that so that when we get into circumstances where we make decisions that are important, that it's, we're thinking community rather than how it benefits oneself.
Yeah, and until then.
Until then.
One of my teachers has been Marianne Woodman. She's a Jungian. And she is incredibly devoted to the body. You know, her Jungian practice has been to bring the body in. And guess what? At the age of 60, she got cancer. Ovarian cancer. She was shocked, she tells us, because she felt that was such a betrayal. This body, she honored so much. And she was so good about the body. Why did the body do this to her? And, you know, ovarian cancer is a nasty cancer. And, you know, she had to go through chemotherapy and all that. And she has the account of it in a book called Bones. It's really so wonderfully honest, you know. So, in the meantime, you know, and I would totally endorse what you're saying as something that we are always moving toward. And but that even somebody who, I just saw her as somebody luminous before, then she has this learning, this lesson, this teaching from her body. And now, she's now 10 or 12, I think she's 12 years since the cancer. She is alive. And she is so luminous now, you know, and she just talks from a place that is so beyond what she did 12 years ago when I thought she was quite a wonderful woman. You know,
like she's got to be 80.
Yeah, so whatever, but I made up the year, 62. I don't know how old she was. She was certainly past 60.
Yeah.
And I think she might be shy of 80, but she's, you know, she's getting up there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Could you just say something, since Albert Nolan mentioned it in these chapters, about the Enneagram and the Myers-Briggs as spiritual, as tools for spiritual growth?
Mm-hmm. I certainly think they're both really, really fine. Some of you know that I spent about 10 years teaching Myers-Briggs. And I took two or three workshops with the Enneagram, thought it was wonderful. And to be sort of really honest, the reason I didn't pursue it is I didn't want to be known as the person who likes maths, you know. I wanted to have a little more freedom, so I didn't go and deepen a study in the Enneagram. The Enneagram is different in radical ways from the Myers-Briggs, in that the Enneagram tries to tease out one's motivation toward life. And then to help you, like we have conscious motivations, but we have unconscious motivations. And it helps us to, say, build up the conscious motivation to have some idea of what the unconscious motivation was. So I think the Enneagram is just so valuable. And I know it's alive and well here in this community because I know of a number of people who participate in it. I think it's not a problem to say, I mean, okay, people often say they don't like it because they don't want to be put in boxes, you know? Well, it's sort of like, if there is, this is a whole, a pie, you know, if one cut of the pie gives you something useful, male and female, dark and light, you know, and another kind of cut of the pie gives you something useful, in the Myers-Briggs, you have basically 8 categories. It's a particular cut of the pie in 4 categories, so you get 16 altogether. This, in mathematics, you can hear the background of my math, is called an elegant system. You know, if you can get lots and lots of juicy stuff from just a few cuts of the pie. And that's what I think the Myers-Briggs does. Its results are not trivial. I cannot tell you the liberation I experienced when I could acknowledge that I was deeply introvert. I'm what they would call an introvert intuitive with thinking, INTJ. And I had to come to terms with the fact that I wasn't a feeling type, which are the nice types, you know. And that it was so liberating to recognize that and recognize that was the case. And that I was going to do my best work coming out of my thinking function, but that didn't mean I couldn't develop my feeling function. But that I am, you know, sort of like, that's my right hand. So I think that, you know, if you want to do that kind of a search, finding good teachers in either one of those areas is so rich. Yeah. Yeah. This will be the last question because time we agreed to end. Yeah.
I just discovered something that's related to both of those called Strength Finders by Gallup.
Okay.
Are you familiar with that?
No.
Oh. So I found it fascinating.
Okay.
It has kind of like you take this assessment online,
uh-huh,
and it has like kind of 30 different fields, but in the end you get this profile of yourself, of your strength,
uh-huh,
and in various areas. And I found that I just began to kind of look at people and situations of myself in terms of strengths rather than deficits. Mm-hmm. Things that annoyed me about people, I could see strengths that, mm-hmm, I hadn't seen before. So I thought it was sort of an interesting turn in, mm-hmm, psychology or whatever it, mm-hmm, is that looks at the way people approach life.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so.
Okay. In terms of math, that I would particularly resonate with would be ones that have a place for the unconscious. And both Myers-Briggs and Enneagram have a place for the unconscious. Ones that operate only out of conscious stance, I see it's okay, but that's not what I would, you know, because you see, you could have a strength, but if you don't look at your weaknesses, you are in some way looking at only one side of the coin. You know, just because the trouble is when we see a weakness that we get preoccupied with it isn't a reason not to look at weakness. Do you hear what I'm
saying? Yeah, I guess what struck me about it is the diversity of strengths that I,
uh-huh,
wasn't ever conscious of.
Okay, okay. So it helped you enlarge yourself and your world around you.
Right.
Yeah. Well, it sounds like it would be very valuable. Again, thank you.